Hello and welcome to CIFAR Sounding. I'm your host, Simba Wiltz.
And I'm Asla Gonser.
CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of the big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
You can find out more about us on our website at cflar.org.
We're also on social media. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cflar and on Twitter at cflarbigcats.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/CFL Animal Reserve.
Our conversation continues this week with Dr. Rajesh Gopal, Secretary General of Global Tiger Forum. Dr. Gopal has worked in tiger conservation for over 37 years and is one of the principal investigators in the recent census that showed a 30% rise in the number of wild tigers in India. In our last discussion, he described this study and its execution, and in this show, we continue the discussion about the challenges of tiger conservation, starting with some description about wildlife corridors. Dr. Gopal is speaking to us via phone from his office in New Delhi.
And the width of the corridor we have suggested is 1.5 kilometers to the left and right.
Wow.
Well, 1.5, the basis is 3 kilometers is the average home range radius of a white tiger based on radio telemetry studies. So 3 kilometers should be covered at least and should be kept little free. I mean, not that to be they have to be made as a protected area. The land uses of people using them and all this can happen. But they deserve a special focus to address the human-tiger interface. That was it. If these things are in place and we are trying to do that, certainly the gene flow will not be affected. And if the gene flow is not affected and if the human-tiger interface is addressed and if we are in a position to innovatively provide livelihood options, so I don't see an alarm for the tiger. But if we turn blind to these issues, then we may suffer.
Let me ask you a question. Earlier we were talking about how the census was done with a set of camera traps. Are those camera traps not deployed all the time? They're only deployed for the census?
No. The camera traps are deployed throughout the year, in fact, in phases. And that we call, that process, we call it the phase 4 monitoring. That is, that goes on year-round, you know, with gaps. You can't keep the camera open on throughout the year because there is a period called as a closure period, 25 days or 30 days, depending on the site. You calibrate and you keep it and capture the tigers. This is an ongoing exercise. We have given cameras to almost all the reserves where it is trappable, where the density, you need a good moderate density of tigers to use the camera trap. Otherwise, in places like in some places in northeast India, like Namdafa, the density of tigers is very, very low. So you can't use camera traps. Only the cause is we collect the tiger scats and then we do the DNA analysis and then we get an idea of tiger presence and tiger numbers. We can go only up to that level. Reserves like Namdafa, reserve like Dampa in Mizoram, again in the northeast. These are two reserves and one or two reserves we have like Palamu in Jharkhand, which has problems. There are extremists in the reserve. You can't enter the reserve freely and deploy the camera. There is one more reserve in central India called Indravati. There you have the left-wing extremism. Extremists are there.
He just mentioned extremists in some of these areas where these camera traps are deployed that are causing trouble. Do you know what he's referring to?
Well, something that doesn't get a lot of press over in the American media, but is certainly on the minds of people in India, is an ongoing conflict taking place between several smaller groups that are trying to splinter away from the Indian government. And several of these groups have actually taken over some of the most sensitive tiger regions. And so in his studies, as well as in other tiger studies, they can't just go into those areas to put up camera traps and count tigers, because many of them are coming as part of the Indian government. So there was an instance in 2010 whereby they did negotiate to allow researchers to go in and track the tigers in that area. But it is considered a far left radical communist group that is taking over some of these areas and making it hard for the researchers to analyze what's going on with the tigers there.
Now, obviously, these are in protected areas, so these people are obviously breaking the law being there in the first place.
Well, a protected area is only as good as its protection. And when you're talking about a group that is literally trying to wage a civil war, they are defending and in some cases pushing into these areas by force. This is not a set of squatters that are moving in there. This is a paramilitary kind of action that is going to cause a lot of damage, a lot more damage, because it can't just be pushed out by simple police force.
Are they also harming the wildlife that live in that area?
It's believed that they have, actually, because not only of taking the land, but in order to fund some of their activities, it is a lot easier for them to take a tiger and sell it to merchants who might be interested in having tiger parts in order to fund their insurgency.
Barring these outliers, three or four sites, in other places, the tigers are trappable in cameras, and that's a good thing. We are building a national repository of tiger camera trap photo database. So 2006 was the starting year. So this time, last time we got a lot of pictures, more than 700. This time we have got individual IDs, more than 1545. So there will be a lot of repeat captures. And this gives us an opportunity also the periodicity, the gap in between. We can treat these populations as open and compute other ecological parameters relating to population, the emigration, the immigration, the birth ratio, the other ratios which otherwise in a closed population assumption you can't compute.
So based on that, it sounds like these camera traps are deployed year-round and have been since 2006 gathering data.
Yes, and what they do is move them around from park to park between the exercises to give some more longitudinal information. So that way, they are tracking the same tigers over and over again, giving a stronger footprint of where they will be for the next census.
And obviously, they must be using some kind of recognition type software to know that they've got the same tiger in that photo.
Either that, or it could be visual. It's because each tiger face is going to look different. They can also do some matching that way.
But when there's over 2,000 tigers, it's got to be difficult to just do it visually.
Well, the good news for them is that with the census data they've got, they will generally know which tigers are in which range, and then also have it broken up by various parks. So what could be over 2,000 tigers really only comes down to maybe a couple of hundred in an individual park.
So I went on to ask Dr. Gopal more about the camera traps themselves.
Now, are these camera traps like infrared motion sensor type things? Like, for example, would they catch people also walking in their
homes? Yeah. Very, very, very nice question. Yes, madam, they capture people, they capture intruders, they capture other interesting fauna also. So the detailed statewide report will emerge in another, say, 3 months from now. So you'll have a lot of lesser-known fauna getting captured, and that's very, very interesting from the zoology point of view.
You mentioned something else that's of major concern to us, the poaching. We know that in terms of international organized crime and terrorism, that poaching has become, and animal trafficking has become, I think, the number four way of funding these things. And with such a growing population,
What is being done to try and protect these parks such that these numbers can continue to grow?
Well, sir, that is the most, the basic challenge for Project Tiger in India, and should be the challenge and the primary task for other countries as well. So we have, as I said, the regular staff, more than now they are around 11,000 frontline staff. They are there in these designated tiger reserves. You have the patrolling camps, which are deep inside the forest. An average reserve of 1,000 square kilometer will have more than 115 patrolling camps. And these are non-family posts. People stay there, they have wireless, and the mobile phone connectivity is not there everywhere. And wireless works very well. And then they have the arms and ammunition, and then they have vehicles as well. But nothing would be can substitute legwork. So a lot of legwork is required in these reserves. Plus, elephants are also deployed. Now, as you said earlier, the local people, they assist. They are the young fellows who are able-bodied. They are very good trekkers. So they are also, they are paid and they are deployed along with the local staff.
I wanted to stop at this point just to highlight something that he just mentioned. We've mentioned in previous shows how being part of the solution as opposed to being part of the problem is such a big part of protecting the tigers. In this case, he's mentioning how the local population is part of protecting the tigers against poachers, and they're compensating them. So it's a monetary value to them to help protect the tigers.
And then the ex-army people are deployed in a big way wherever they are available. Then the home guards are there. They are deployed wherever they are available. We provide 100% funding support from the federal government to do all this. And then one more important thing which has happened in the recent years is the Special Tiger Protection Force. Now, this is an operation as far as before I left the Tiger Project area, the office, in six places this was already deployed. Now, this is a special commando force, so which were people below 40 years, up to 40 years they continue in that force and they get absorbed later in the regular establishment within the Forest Department of respective state. And these people are recruited and then trained in the police academy, and the forest basics are imparted to them. So the battalion is small, 112 people are there in a force, STPF force. So these are given to reserves where you have problems and you have tigers and you have proximity to some border and all that. So this is also helping us. And then another thing which is happening in a big way is the 24/7 electronic surveillance. We call this as the e-surveillance. So if you come to India, we'll show you this in Corbett. Now it's working in Bhopal, Central India and Madhya Pradesh also. So, and now we have given support to Kaziranga in Assam because of the rhino poaching. Now these are intelligent thermal as well as infrared cameras which are mounted on specially constructed towers on the periphery or wherever the local manager feels people do intrude and you need a surveillance there. So they are in operation round the clock and they send the alerts. Even in the night, you have the images coming constantly to the control room and people can get alerted through these alerts and rush to the spot and capture the offenders. So we have a lot of footages of tiger in Corbett caught in this, lot of elephants. A lot of intruders have also been caught. Of course, there are filters to filter out the movement of staff, the regular bona fide staff. But this is another thing which has happened. And of course, the most important thing is the phase 4 monitoring, as I said. Since you have reserve-wise minimum number of tigers with IDs, the moment they are not seen, you can find out something. Either they have gone aside or they have been killed or they are missing. So you can monitor them, their presence, where what exactly has gone wrong. And then you have the smart patrolling coming in a big way, the M stripes. You must have heard about the SMART, S-M-A-R-T, SMART being done in by some organizations in some countries. In collaboration with the Zoological Society of London, the Wildlife Institute of India, and we at the Tiger Authority, we have done this, and it's there in 8 reserves to further refine the petroleum. Now, we call our brand of petroleum protocol, SMART protocol, as M stripes, is small M and then stripes. M stands for monitoring, in the sense, apart from the getting the patrolling intensity, where all the staff, frontline staff has patrolled, where all it has neglected, it also gives you a lot of information about the ecological attributes of the habitat, which the staff can capture through a very customized facility in a user-friendly manner. And then they can address those issues and fine-tune their managerial prescriptions. So these things are happening on the protection front, and it's a very, very serious issue. And apart from field protection, the most other big challenge is to readily compensate the loss of livestock in the peripheral areas, because as I said earlier, a lot of cattle are picked up by tigers which move out, and if the tigers do frequent such areas, and if these issues are not addressed, people poison them. They put poison in the kill, and the tiger eats in bouts, doesn't eat the entire thing in one go. So this habit of tiger is known to locals.
It's interesting what he just brought up about these cattle that are on the border areas of these tiger preserves, that sometimes the tigers do attack them and eat them. But this whole concept of not eating them all at once, and how the locals use that against the tiger.
Well, a tiger is, even the best tiger is only going to be able to eat about 75 pounds at a sitting, maybe 100 if they're being really, really adventurous. But that being said, cattle is going to be much over 100 pounds, a great deal over 100 pounds. And so at some point, they're going to have to either leave that kill or stop eating, which is when the farmers take their opportunity to do a revenge killing.
Right. So they poison the cattle, and when the tiger comes back to eat the rest, they poison the tiger.
Precisely.
So you have to be very vigilant. You have to compensate them, and you have to keep a watch on the carcass till it's completely devoured and eaten and by the tiger. It should not be disturbed. So this is another challenge, and the tiger which has made the kill is again identified through the camera trap IDs which the field manager has in his custody. So the ID is known. Sometimes aberrant animals also happen. We lose a lot of people, and they pick up the human beings and due to chance encounters, but then get branded as man-eaters. We lost, in fact, a tiger was eliminated very recently. That was a very unfortunate incident somewhere in South India. And then, in fact, that was in Wayanad, in Kerala. That was the second such incident. So these issues are very, very important. And then on the international front, there is a demand in China for body parts and derivatives. And we have China is a signatory to CITES convention, so are we. So on that platform, we flag this issue. Many countries support, but there are a lot of captive tigers in China, and there is no rocket science. In fact, it's impossible to distinguish the meat or the body part from the captive tiger with that of those coming from a wild tiger. But why I'm saying this, because I have raised this in CITES conference of parties several times. They must put an end to this demand, and that's there in the traditional pharmacopoeia, which is going to be very difficult. The last 20 years I've been seeing, there's no Nothing has progressed much on this, despite CITES and other conventions and other. We have a bilateral with China. India has a bilateral, especially on tigers. We have a bilateral with Bhutan. We have a bilateral with Nepal, with Russian Federation, with Bangladesh as well recently. But the main issue is the demand. You know, there's no demand in India for the body parts and derivatives of tigers. But due to this pharmacopoeia in China, and attributing all kinds of properties to medicinal properties to the tiger derivatives, tiger wine, tiger balm, so many things. So the wild don't suffer, and the rise in numbers throws up this challenge as well to secure the tigers more, because whatever tigers may be bred in captivity, the medicinal properties are attributed to the tigers which grow in the wild. It's like a broiler and your country egg. Mm-hmm. The properties are there only in the wild ones. So the wild ones would get depleted under the garb of, would be laundered under the garb of the captive ones. So these are issues.
Yes, those are significant issues that we've certainly heard about on this side of the world as well. And you mentioned the whole issue of captive tigers, that you can't tell the difference between the two parts. But I remember that seeing that there was actually some talk of cubs or otherwise being being shipped or sent to aid captive populations. Where do you see the interface between the captive populations and how that contributes to conservation in the wild?
Excellent, excellent, Doctor. This is a very, very important ex situ to in situ is very important in tiger conservation.
Before we go on with this explanation, do you think you could explain for me what ex situ and in situ means?
Sure, and it's real easy to get those two mixed up. Basically, the two words ex situ, both and in situ, have the root in situ, S-I-T-U, which is the situation, so to speak. So in the case of ex situ, that means that it's the conservation or keeping of animals, fauna, flora, in captivity versus in situ, which is their natural state.
And when you have, there are a lot of areas. India, we had Chariska, we had Panna. So we could, in Panna especially, we could transfer successfully two tigresses, which have been bred in a in situ enclosure, but treating them as ex situ. In the sense, they were in a big enclosure. The enclosure was within the reserve, no disturbance. And there was, initially there was a Pavlovian conditioning for these cubs when they were in infancy. Later, weaning, they lost their mother, so it was red, hand red. Then they were wilded, rewilded. So it took us 5 years.
Wow.
After rewilding, yes. And this gave us lot of hope. In fact, I'm quite enthusiastic about this. And then the rewilded ones, the tigresses, mind you, they were taken successfully to Panna. And after, of course, they could predate, stalk and predate as many as more than 100 spotted deer. They were declared fit for release. And they were released and radio-collared and released. And they are breeding very well.
So I wanted to ask the question about this rewilding that he talks about that took him 5 years to accomplish.
Rewilding is the sometimes unsuccessful process of taking a cub from being in a captive situation and making them fit to survive in the wild. The most classic rewilding story might be that of Elsa, the lioness from Born Free. You may also hear stories about Christian the lion being rewilded, but usually you don't hear stories about tigers being rewilded, and that's really the source of, I think, his excitement, and really should be all of our excitements, because some people have said that it's just not possible to adequately rewild tigers in their native lands. And based on this discussion, it's just proved that that's not true.
But this is obviously a complex process to get from the point of having a captive tiger to a point of having one that can survive on its own.
And it's a very successful thing which has happened. And also, some orphan cubs are being reared in Bandhavgarh Tiger Reserve in Madhya Pradesh. Again, they will be sent after rewilding to some other promising area. And similar thing is happening in Maharashtra, another central Indian state, where the ex-situ cubs, after rewilding, are being taken. It will be done soon in a few days or a few weeks. So it will be sent to another promising site with a collar for monitoring. So a lot of work is there to repopulate the countries, the habitats where tigers have gone locally extinct. So the rewilding has been more or less standardized in the Indian conditions. We have a protocol, and they are there in the website of Tiger Conservation Authority. So it's very challenging, it's very interesting, and a lot of hope for repopulating promising areas where they are gone deeply, like Cambodia, for example. Now, Cambodia is interested to revive its tiger population, wild tiger population. So informally, they have spoken to us, we have spoken to them, we are waiting for a formal call from them, a letter or a communication to our government. Then I am sure with this experience, they can be hand-holded from ex-situ to in-situ transfer can be done.
Well, now, actually, what you just said, though, if you were to repopulate, like, Cambodia, as you mentioned, with tigers from India, does that also change the genetic flow, though, in a way that wouldn't be normal?
Yes, I agree. So the first choice would be, of course, where the subspecies is, they're still in the nearby countries, tiger range countries. That option has to be explored. Not to pick up from India, it's a different subspecies. Only if that option is not available, we have to fall back on this option vis-a-vis the IUCN guidelines. But IUCN guidelines say that only when the subspecies is not found in the wild at all. That is not the situation in Cambodia. The subspecies which used to be there is still there in other close by countries, like if I remember, Thailand probably.
All of this presents some very interesting possibilities for the tigers in the future. We could be looking at a situation whereby the tigers are repopulated, but may be repopulated entirely with the help of those tiger programs that are actually successful. That's all the time we have for this week. Tune in next week as we conclude our discussion with Dr. Gopal, talking more about the very complex world of the wild tiger and conservation, as well as how the world of the wild tiger and the world of the captive tiger can combine forces to make a better world for tigers in the future.
CFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
Send us your thoughts. You can get us on email via contact@cflar.org.
Tune in again next week for more discussion. My name is Asla Gonser.
And I'm Simba Wiltz. Thanks for listening to CFAR Sounding. Thank you.